Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Good evening, planet Earth. Good evening to the Dixie Riders and those Hellstone folk that live near the edge of the Great Desert. Good evening to the Carnies, setting up tents. Somewhere near Peru, Indiana. Good evening to the prophets. Selling stories, all gory, filled with glory. Good evening, prophets, telling your filthy lies. It is still June the 25th, 2026, and it's your good friend Dan talking here. Keep it on the DL, under the spectrum, within range of sight, not far from shore. My ship is taking on water. June the 25th, 2026. Did you go to the grocery store? Did you buy it like a whore? Did you see the ground beef, suckling and tasty, smiling to you, cheeseburger Friday, but it's too much, so you keep on walking. Keep on walking, hobo. Get another job, they say. Get another job, they say. Two or three more jobs. What if I told you there was enough space for every single person, every homeless person, every person in the United States of America, that there was enough space for everybody to live? I don't mean live fancy. I don't mean we all get to live like we're the Jetsons or we all get swimming pools. But what if there's enough space that everybody for a reasonable amount of money could live with a level of dignity? What if that was real? And it's one of those questions that a lot of folks have trouble asking because it seems like we're saying, well, no, we can't forget capitalism. We can't forget free enterprise. But listen, I believe in free enterprise. But if you think Fannie and Freddie and the way that the housing market works is free enterprise, I think you're very much confused. So there's plenty of space. There's plenty of space for everybody to be able to hang their hat, to go to sleep at night in a reasonable level of comfort. Probably they're going to have Wi-Fi. There's enough space for everybody. And if you do it smart, you don't have to create more urban clutter. But the bottom line is, there is enough space. The question is, why don't we? Why do we have people in the streets, especially when you think about things like heat waves or cold snaps or any type of blizzard? Mother Nature doesn't, you know, is not kind. It's like the Dr. Freckles quote, right? That Dr. Freckles quote. Nature doesn't do what's fair, it does what's necessary. And you're not always going to like the outcomes, really, I don't think. Neither will I. But if you're asking the simple question, could we build habitats for people across the country? Yes. Are we going to do it in time? No. No. Things will probably start falling apart long before we even begin to rationalize our approach to homelessness. And frankly, the way that we allow shelter to become a financial scam. And I don't think it's about more laws. I think what you have to do is pull out the chair from underneath it, which means you need to get rid of the central banks. But nobody's going to do it because it's a free credit card. And it's a free credit card not just for the housing boom. It's a free credit card for the wars and the SUVs and the landfills filled with shit that builds up year after year, mainly because we probably could build a washing machine that would last 100 years. We could. I have no doubt that we could, but we're not gonna. That's not the way the current system is designed to work. I'd love to believe that there's a solutioneering process, but it's like the previous brief podcast about the loach. The loach. Not all loaches are bad, just like not all the Irish are bad. You know, some Irish are bad. Some of us are real bad. Some of us are cursed with a darkness that takes hold of us when we're young. We see into the pitch black. We have a soul heart attack. We glimpse beyond the veil. And then we take sail in a bottle of whiskey. I don't know. This fish, the loach, yeah, it's a carp. It's a bottom feeder. That's the other thing, too. You have to meditate on the fact that it's a bottom feeder. Now, you think about the terminology, it really is insulting to things like carps and halibut and flounders and, you know, skates and other fish that feed at the bottom, including the octopus. It's a bottom feeder. It doesn't mind feeding off the crabs that live at the bottom. And the crabs, man, people love eating those. And crabs are the penultimate bottom feeders. They're living at the bottom, even near sulfur vents, living off of gumptus and crombiosis, tens of thousands of feet below the surface of the ocean. You'll find these crabs living large, living big, with the giant tube worms as their friends. Yeah. I don't know. The loach hides in its little cave. It's a bottom feeder. It hides in its cave. And when you walk by and you're happy, if you have a smile on your face and the loach sees it, it marks you for death. And so if you're a happy, shiny fish swimming around, okay, just swimming around the sea, the loach don't want that. The loach wants obedient pets with devilish appetites. It wants the monster. It wants the sinful darkness. It wants its own reproach. It sees its own commitment to its own persecution as an allocution with erudition. Be quiet, you pedant. No, I don't know. It's a little bastard, right? That's the loach, right? That's a story that my friend from, you know, Patagonia sent me, the fisherman. And you think about the fisherman's life, okay? Okay, what's his shelter? His shelter is his boat. You know, I jokingly discussed the issue because I thought that it would make a great documentary by Werner Herzog called The Republic of Tigers and Bears, all about a man who wants to reinvent America around really a kind of chutes and ladders society of tigers and bears. You'd be walking down the street to go get some type of coffee, and a bear or a tiger or both might attack you. Maybe they fight each other. You upload that to YouTube. It would put society on edge again. People would carry swords. People would carry swords and battle axes. They would probably take better care of themselves. They would probably be more interested in a healthier and, frankly, more sustainable diet if they had the threat of this sort of constant attack around them all the time. And I don't know, maybe that's the purpose of the loach, is just to remind you that, listen, buddy, it ain't all good, it ain't all okay, I don't know. But it did sound like a murder situation of total death, and, you know, maybe the loach is like the state of Iran. Like, maybe you just don't fuck with the loach. Just leave it alone. It all it wants is its little cave. Stay away from the cave. If you get within a certain distance, it'll strike you and try to bite you. But if you just give it its space, you know, maybe the loach is okay. The loach is okay. I don't think that we are at the point in the game where we can really brainstorm anything that would fix this. I was thinking about like the Dane Wigington thing. Here's a guy who ostensibly respects science, and that's really good. But his main agenda with his population of people out there who would love to volunteer is not to take core samples of ponds or soil samples, or to collect rain samples, or do things on a crowd basis to take actual data. Because if he's right, this stuff is everywhere. It's more or less just to go to certain specialized insiders. He has the capacity to organize on a crowd basis to do some good science. And he says things like, well, now is the time of what? Lawsuits and documentaries and handouts? I don't know. I think one way to get people headed in the right direction is to find out that your neighbor is actually applying science to the world around them. And so at least we can understand what this fallout is, but it's kind of too late. You know? I think one of the great services of the internet for the people that love to control us is it can create the illusion that somebody is doing something very easily, way better than radio or TV or newspapers. You can create a deluge of bullshit around something's happening, somebody's doing something. You can find a YouTube video, 100 YouTube videos of people doing something. And because you can do that, you don't have to worry about it. It doesn't matter if it's fusion energy or feeding the poor or bringing water to the desert. You'll find a video, maybe 100 videos, that says somebody is fixing it, somebody's solving it, someone's making it better. And if there's a problem, like, for example, the drought and its impact on the Southwest and the fact that the mountains haven't really gotten enough snow in the last few years, if there's a problem, you go ahead and you blame it on paperwork, right? But these are the same bozos who will tell you, you need to vote because we need more paperwork. Well, okay. You know, conveniently you can blame your system. Well, we just, Dan, you know, it's not a perfect system. They didn't know. Yeah. I'd venture to guess they knew a lot more 100 years ago about the situation than we do today, but at the level they lived at, some of them, maybe not all of them. Whatever's going on. But to say that the coming cliff or waterfall or edge or event horizon, to say it's avoidable is absurd. There's too much energy in the system. Now, you could contend, and again, this is using my own thought experiments against me. You could say, well, Dan, this is the great discontinuity. You called it in 2019, and I stick with it. History is unstuck. On a certain level, it absolutely is. I still think they're trying to manage it, but are they managing it well? Well, actually, they are. They're not removing the reality of it, but they're convincing people it's not really happening. So that's kind of brilliant. It only works up to a point. I mean, really up to the stomach, right? But, yeah. Loach. So I don't know. Whatever it is, it seems to me it's going to be big. I kind of hope it's not. But it's probably going to be significant enough that when it starts happening, history as we know it is going to be defined by a new marker. I would say that, like, you know, if you want to be an optimist, Dan, I'm an optimist. I like Star Trek. They had a really messed up 21st century in that fictional series. So maybe the same thing's happening here. But don't we get some magical scientist who builds a faster-than-light ship and he brings the Vulcans to visit us? So isn't that okay, Dan? Yeah, that's an island that the hang glider can get to. And I don't want to go over the hang glider thought experiment again, but briefly, you've got a hang glider, you have a bunch of little islands. Most of the ones that are close, not all, are terrible. Most of the pretty cool ones are way off in the distance, and the water is filled with sharks. So you're in a very tough situation. If you can get way out there and land on one of the really cool islands, you'll be okay. So maybe we do land randomly on an island that's cool. Maybe we do end up contacting aliens and they give us super technology because they're friendly. They're not at all evil. And they don't want to serve man. No, no, no. We're not going to be the taco meat. In fact, they find us disgusting, but they want to help us because they think we're so smelly. They can smell us across dimensions and light years and parsecs. They can smell us through wormholes, and they want us to be a lot less smelly. So they basically are going to just help us. They're going to help us with a magical jelly. Yeah. What did Ron Jeremy say? Yeah. I don't know. So yeah, I don't know. I think I was telling people this 10 years ago in Indianapolis. If you want to think of it like a flush, you can. And the only thing you can really do is try to find some crusty on the side of the bowl that you can hold on to and help your family, the people you care about, hold on to. But the reality is, it's like asking a question, you know, like, or rather making the statement. You run into somebody, they drink too much, they use drugs, they do things that are dangerous. And you say to them, that's going to kill you. But all I can tell everybody that listens to me ever is that something's going to kill you. It may not kill you now, it may kill you later. You may end up getting killed and you'll be in a bed surrounded by people that love you. They're not killing you, but you die. And you say, well, I'm using the term incorrectly, but listen, everybody's going to get killed or dead somehow. If you don't like the word kill, you can say die, but it ends up happening. It's just going to happen. Some people die of cancer when they're young. Some people lived on an old age and get hit by a car. You know? Other than God, if you believe in God, nobody's immortal. So it's not smart to ask the question, is this about life or death? Every day is about life or death, right? The smart question is, how do you make it through? It's kind of like the aquarium problem. It's an oversimplification, but that's the issue. It's hard to teach people about problems like this without oversimplifying at times. It's like when you learn military tactics. It's all kind of just book learning and maybe even just practice too, but ultimately the real thing is different. I was never in combat, but I'm 100% convinced it's very different from any kind of training I ever did. So what you have right now, what I have, if you're lucky, is a very cartoonish map of the future, and it's going to be crazy. And there's going to be a lot of chaos. It's not just about what might be happening with the climate. That could be bad enough. If we're drifting in the hothouse Earth, and it looks like we may be, in the very least, that means a couple things. Yes, the land-based ice, which is the ice that threatens mostly the sea rise, is about to catastrophically melt. That's A. And B, if you live between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, you're probably going to have to move. I mean, you won't necessarily have to move, but it's probably going to become quite unlivable in hothouse Earth. And it could stay locked in that equilibrium forever, or at least for so long it might as well be forever. Let's say 1 million years. But Dan, the human race will be traveling into outer space, spreading herpes and our disgrace to the very edge of the cosmos. We'll be having sex with robots. We'll be getting divorced from robots. We'll be splitting the summer home with robots. The timeshare. The robot can have the timeshare. The robot can have the timeshare, right? Because they suck. I don't know. Maybe we land on the magical card, the magical square. Maybe we're fine. Maybe door number 2 has what we want. We open it, it's fine. But barring a miracle of technology, which can happen, and I don't mean the fake bullshit they tell you. I mean a real, authentic event that changes things economically from the ground up. Barring something like that, things are going to get really messy. And it won't be gradual. It won't be linear. It will be discontinuous. It'll be brutal. It'll be cascading. One thing will create 2 other problems. Those 2 other problems will create 16 others. Those 16 will create 1,000. Those 1,000 will create 1.2 million. And it sounds crazy, but it will be like that, an expanding, unpredictable, chaotic tree. And it's hard to say what the first big thing will be, but it's certainly going to be an issue of some of these heat waves. Are they going to be survivable with our current grid? If we go through this every year, and it probably will be like this every year until things stabilize, and they might not stabilize in our generation. It's not just that you get locked into hothouse Earth. There's a transition period, and that transition period, you know, the way they used to paint it was it'll be 100 years, it'll be 200 years. They'll take these significant events and say they're 100 or 200 years away. Worst case scenario. And now it's like, no, it's next year, it's next month. It's not quite like that, but it's pretty close to it. So they're adjusting their timelines a lot, by 50 years in a lot of cases. And if you want to come back and say, well, Dan, they just didn't have the good science, I think they probably understood more than we realize about the current situation. I think, you know, people like Al Gore, Greta Thunberg, their purpose is to be disinformation agents. Their purpose is to be paid fools. That's their job. Their job is to take an issue that might be serious and turn it into a joke. And so that's why they're so good at being jokes. But what we're talking about right now is not a joke. It's like Extinction Rebellion. That reminds me of the whole, you know, Occupy Wall Street bullshit. Completely synthetic, AstroTurf, CIA, Mossad, MI6 bullshit. Ground up crap. Twice cooked rice beans. Yeah. Twice cooked pork soup. You know. I don't know, folks. My base case 10 years ago was, if we're lucky, we're facing economic collapse. My base case 10 years ago was, if we're unlucky, the most likely outcome is probably some type of nuclear war. And I was up front in that. I think my estimates were a little bit off. I expected it to happen sooner. I really did. I kind of thought the Ukraine war situation, and really, it didn't really just start in 2022. The Ukraine conflict really started in 2014. But for that conflict and for that brewing scenario, it looked terrible to me. Yet in retrospect, I think I overreacted because there was more going on, you know? I don't believe these things are nearly as organic as I thought they were a decade ago, but I'll stick with my best case from a decade ago, and that is a century of chaos. And then maybe on the other side, there is this Renaissance part two. It could happen, but it's going to be at least, you know, optimistically 20 to 30 years of chaos, and I think it's going to be more like 100 years. And that probably does include some type of war. Does it mean total nuclear war? Well, I mean, listen, there's a guy, I think his name was Herman Kahn, he wrote the book on it, and there's different levels of nuclear war, and nuclear war can be limited. Will it be limited? I have no idea. There's a movie that came out in 1990 that HBO produced. I think it was called Dawn's Early Light. That's a pretty good film on quote-unquote limited nuclear war theory, the idea that you can shut them down. And there's some stuff in there that I think is based, and some of it's not quite based. But on one level, it's a pretty based movie. Failsafe is actually another really good movie on the concept of limited nuclear war. And in this case, it deals with an accident. You know, what if we accidentally nuked a Russian city during the Cold War? What would we do? The funny thing is, Failsafe came out the same year as Dr. Strangelove. And Dr. Strangelove really deals with the worst case. And that is doomsday. You know, the idea that, or at least for all intents and purposes, polluting the Earth in such a way that humans would have to live underground for hundreds of thousands of years. For a long, long time. For at least thousands of years. If not at least hundreds. The point is, you'd have to live in caves. And that's kind of how the movie ends. Failsafe deals with that scenario where we accidentally drop a bomb on Moscow, and so the president, played by Henry Fonda, negotiates a deal where we end up sacrificing, I believe, New York City. It's kind of a horrible idea and a horrible film because the dude, the pilot responsible for dropping the bomb in Failsafe, spoiler alert, his wife lives, his family, his kids live in New York City. He ends up having to nuke them. And he ends up taking poison at the end because, hey, I just killed my wife and my kids in order to avoid total nuclear war. So there, you know, there's in fiction, and I think in military science and research, there are examples of people developing scenarios of limited nuclear war. And yeah, we're talking about it. Let's talk about it. I don't know if nukes are real. I don't know what this has to do with being a loach, but let's talk about it. There are people who believe that you can turn a nuclear war off. I think that's iffy. There are people who believe that there are levels of engagement that are limited by nature. They don't have to lead to total nuclear war, that you don't have to go from 0 to 100. And this is something a lot of theoreticians believe. They also believe that in the case of limited nuclear war, you can win it. So for example, look at Iran. Right now, what we know is our conventional weapons are useless against them. And yes, we could fight a war of attrition. And if we wanted to commit to total economic collapse worldwide right now, we could just have our World War III and it could be in Iran, because for all intents and purposes, fighting Iran would be the equivalent of fighting Nazi Germany. And not that they're Nazis, but it would be equivalent of facing that kind of a military force. This is not Iraq. This is not Panama or Venezuela, not Cuba. This is a nation of almost 100 million people who, yeah, that's not a perfect place. I don't know that I'd want to live there or I'd be allowed to live there. But it's also not the United States of America. And in that sense, it's none of our business. And as far as the waters go, I don't know. People need to research maritime law because for all intents and purposes, the portion of the Strait of Hormuz that Iran wants to set up tolls for, they more or less own. It's 12 nautical miles. They own it. People need to research this subject. Oman owns the other 12 nautical miles. There you go. But as far as the rest of it goes, what we kind of attack them. So there's no moral basis for this. But yeah, you can go all in with them. Your next best option, and this is the thing I've been talking about for years, folks, for years. If you listen to my podcast, I've been very consistent. I talked to you about the Come As You Are war years ago. In fact, I remember doing a podcast, I think in 2018. Yeah, you'd have to go into my archives, but I dealt with the subject. Maybe it was 2019. And I dealt with the subject very deliberately. I said, here is the deal. This is what happens. And I've discussed it more seriously since. We don't make weapons the way we used to. You know, we don't even make them like we did during World War II. Our weapons are, by their nature, very complex. And the argument that the seller makes is that this weapon is equal to 10 of the other thing. And that's the basic argument. And sometimes that logic works, but it's not a very good basis of designing weapons or having a military that can make a lot of them. The other problem is that there's an inherent profit incentive. And I don't think we should have any wars at all. I think that this nation would be stronger if our defense was 100% voluntary, but also meaning no professional military, all of it militia, because we have become too detached in terms of our military from where we live. And so that citizen ethic needs to return, and it can't operate that way, the way it currently operates. And if you come back to me and say, well, Dan, we can't have elite forces, I think we would have more elite forces if we did it the right way. But that's a separate topic. You know, I don't want to go into it. So a come as you are war is a war where you have so many weapons, and once you use them up, it's done. That kind of happened to us with Iran. Okay, we had so many of a certain type of weapons, and we believed they would work, period. No debate. Our systems were perfect. They were perfect. They would work. And if they had done the magic they expected, and if decapitation was going to result in some sort of rebellion or coup d'etat, it would have happened. But the intelligence was bad. They told them that the government was wobbly. I don't think the evidence was there for that, not the level that they sold it. So we had so many months of weapons and so many months of interceptors and Patriots. And let's not get into that discussion, but the Patriots are not necessarily that great a weapon system. So even if you had a ton of them, it doesn't necessarily help you against hypersonics or drones, frankly, not really. Not drone swarms. You take out one or two. You won't take out the swarm. So at the end of the day, we came to a gunfight with the wrong type of guns, the wrong type of skills, and we thought we were going to win by just breathing, by just blowing air out, and it didn't happen. And so we went through all those materials, and now they're saying, well, we can't reproduce them. Again, I'm trying to play the game that there's not something deeper going on. I frankly think this is more of the use up weapons before your military's mutiny game. But let's pretend it's the real game and this is a real organic conflict. We can no longer conduct a functional conventional operation unless we commit to total war, period. And total war means rationing. Total war means a draft. It means an enforced draft, which means you are going to have people going out there finding people. It won't just be so easy to go to Canada. You're talking about committing to a police state situation for 5 to 10 years. And that's if you want to destroy or fight or win against Iran, whatever that means. And then you're going to have to occupy it for a period of time. So at least 10 years. 5 years, if you're lucky, the war lasts. Maybe it's faster. Another 5 years of occupation. Why don't we just average it out to 10 years? 10 years of commitment, probably forces in the realm of what we would have called an army during World War II, which was about 1 million people, several corps, many divisions under each corps, a full army, about 1 million people. Maybe you'd need more than 1 million. Some people think you'd need 3 or 4 or 5 million. Those troops will take months to train, not days, not weeks, months. You will be going through months of training, and then you're going to have operational training, and that's before the first engagement. So if you pulled the trigger on this scenario of us having a conventional fight, knock and roll 'em, rock 'em, sock 'em robots, Best case scenario, the first serious American forces are entering in any number the Iranian territory, let's say 2 to 3 years from now. Maybe 2 years. Maybe you start getting in there in 2 years. That's very optimistic. And in that period of time, the world economy has collapsed. In that period of time, we've created a whole bunch of new enemies. In that period of time, China can do whatever it wants to with Taiwan, including the soft takeover, which it looks like what they're doing is a soft takeover. Very similar to what they did with Hong Kong, except for in this case, there is really no third party except for us. And in this case, I don't think we do anything. I think we let them do the soft takeover. So Taiwan is going to be part of China in one form or another within a few years. And if we were to commit to full-scale conventional war against Iran, then that timetable speeds up. Mr. and Mrs. Loach, right? That's a good name for people, Loach. A serial killer named Loach. That's a good movie about a serial killer called Loach. Yeah. So you spin through your weapons. And again, they theorized about this during the Cold War, that the United States, that the Soviet Union, in a full-scale conventional conflict, would reach a point where one or the other or both would run out of their primary conventional weapons. And we thought it would be us because it seemed like the Soviets had an infinite supply of BRDMs and T-80s and this and that. And certainly Brezhnev did build up their forces. So they had a lot of conventional weapons. So our thought was at some point we would run out of conventionals and the only option we would have would be nuclear. And that's one of the reasons why we had tactical nuclear weapons like the Pershing system in Europe back in the 70s and up until the first missile agreements that dealt with those systems, the intermediate range agreements. We had these limited range, you know, multi-kiloton systems designed to take out large tank formations, to take out various types of army logistical centers. They're not big bombs. They're bombs like Hiroshima scale. And then you come back and say, well, damn, that was pretty big. Well, by today's standards, not that big. But 5 to 10 kilotons. And something that was deployed, you know, the Air Force, I don't know if it was the Army or Air Force that commanded the Pershings. I know that we used to have Nike Hercules and those had nukes on them. And those were for large formations of bombers, you know. And also missile defense. Yeah. They figured 90 days in, which funny, interesting, whatever, enough, whatever, with the Iran thing. It seems like within about 30 days, we reached the point where we were either going to push the envelope and completely drain and culminate, or make some type of quick deal. The Iranians have a geographical advantage. They're, if you just have to look at a map, the country is like a mystical country from some story you'd read by like whatever. I don't know. My brain is blanking right now. Tolkien, right? Tolkien. It is something like from Tolkien, a mystical land, and it's very mountainous, and where there aren't mountains, there's deserts, and yes, there's a sliver, a piece of desert between the Caspian and the mountains that looks kind of livable and nice, and you can target that, but that's further away from both the State of Israel and any of our bases. It's ultimately closer to Russia, and once you get into that airspace, you're getting into Russian airspace, and that very quickly becomes World War III. And there are a few countries in the area that we could probably say, hey, help us out, you know. Russia's not the only country on the Caspian, but yeah, you basically have a very difficult situation when it involves that particular airspace where Tehran is, where that area is. Other than that, you're talking about mountains and deserts and lots of caves and lots of tunnels and lots of bunkers. And it really does seem like a gigantic version of Iwo Jima, except for in this case, Iwo Jima is Japan. And if we had to fight a giant Iwo Jima, it would have been just as impossible. This is an impossible map. You can have all the Green Beret and all the Navy SEALs and all the special forces you ever wanted. this map and this situation is impossible given our current level of readiness. If you want to fight Iran, you have to go up to a level of readiness that means total war. So, what option do we have left? Nuclear. And we do. We have nuclear weapons, which are probably top secret, which means I am probably hypothesizing. But we probably have focal point plasma directed type nuclear burst weapons. These are fourth generation nuclear weapons that can penetrate very deep and send very deep penetrating neutron and gamma radiation. So that even if you have something buried way deep within some mountain someplace, we probably have nukes, at least a few, that if you know, maybe it takes two or three. That's the thing. Maybe you send in one shot and then another and then a third. Maybe they've modeled it. We don't know. So we probably do have nukes like that at this point. We might have directed energy weapons that would be relatively effective. And then there's the question, and it's sort of a spooky question, and Dane Wigington throws it out there, and in the movie Conspiracy Theory, 1997, it plays a minor part in the storyline, the idea that the United States might have the ability to generate an earthquake. And again, folks, I don't know why we would want to do this to Venezuela, except just to take their oil. That's cheaper and easier to invade, and also it does create a distraction. But all of that is quite evil because a lot of people got killed. And you're left with this idea that this is the thing that Dane Wigington says a lot, and he's 100% correct about, they don't care about us. They really don't. They might not even care about themselves, but they certainly don't care about us. So something like this seems horrific to ordinary people because a lot of us have a soul. But would a soulless person do something like this in order to create a distraction, in order to create an event that sort of pulls us off of the Iranian narrative? Who knows, man? In our current situation with Iran, our next best option is nuclear. Everybody knows this. It's sort of strange that people aren't accepting this. There are nuclear weapons we have that would allow us to take out every single one of their missile bases. We could do it. It would not be pretty. It would not be okay. It would kill a lot of people. We could completely obliterate Tehran. Their population centers are concentrated enough, again, because it's mountains and deserts, folks, okay? So they have relatively concentrated population centers. If we wanted to, we could launch a nuclear attack. Israel could launch a nuclear attack on Iran. And for all intents and purposes, they would win within a matter of days. Now, winning in this case basically means murdering 50 to 60 million Iranians, which is horrific. And there's nobody I know that's a real person with a real soul that would advocate killing more than half of the people in Iran. But if you wanted to win, given our current state of readiness, the only option you have is nuclear. That's it. There's no other option. You could say conventional, but I already explained to you, and other people have explained this too, you know. I've been talking about this for years. Other people have been talking about recently with respect to Iran. We do not make weapons the way we used to. If we wanted to deploy against Iran, we would have to massively re-engineer our Defense Department, how we're producing weapons, and we would have to commit to total war. And I just don't think Americans understand what that means because nobody's alive to remember it. Even the Vietnam War was not still total war. It was war, there was a draft, but we were still trying to have our guns and our butter and trying to live the illusion that America worked, right? We had a functional system. That mask comes off and we become a militaristic police state if we want to fight a conventional war. And then we have to keep doing that forever or until we're destroyed. The other option is horrific, and it's nuclear. And the other option outside of all these is to simply try to make peace, which I wish they would. But I think there's a country on the Mediterranean that borders Lebanon and Syria and Egypt and Jordan and other places. I think there's a little country that just basically doesn't want any peace at all. you know, not until they control everything. And this has nothing to do with religion, really. It's about sociopathy, and maybe even that sociopathy itself is a genetic trait. And this brings us full circle, people, back to our friend the Loach. We shall now broach the subject. Lox and bagels, cream cheese. Give me that Loach. We shall not broach. So let's say we launch a nuclear attack on Iran. Maybe we don't hit that many spots. Maybe we simply do what's called a proof attack, which is to say, and this is again, getting back to the idea, the theory of limited nuclear war. We do a proof attack. We show we can take out some of their missile bases and they suffer some damage and we give them time to respond. In that scenario, they could, you know, do a massive launch against Gulf states and completely wreck infrastructure. They could massively wreck the infrastructure of desal plants in state of Israel. There's a lot of things they could do, but in that scenario, their best play would probably be to come back to the table and say, okay, let's make a deal because this is horrific. I think the people that run Iran are saner than the people that run our country is my point. So if you're asking, is there a point where they would be willing to make a deal because they're simply afraid of more death? Yes, there is, but you'd have to go nuclear. And the proof attack would have to be significant enough that you could say, look at this. Those systems, that magical Yazdi base underneath the mountain, well, guess what? Fourth generation nukes can do a lot of things that are quite amazing and horrific and toxic and pollute the land for a long, long time. Long time. And here's the thing, with these things, we're not talking Pershing 5 kiloton, 10 kiloton, we're going to take out an armored column type tactical nukes. We're talking about nukes with yields between 1 and 10 megatons, highly advanced stuff, very much more like rich neutron type bombs than just standard bombs. And that amount of directed gamma ray and neutron radiation is profound. And again, some of these nukes, they've been tested, but a lot of it, let's be honest, all the testing since the 90s is in a computer model. So they've been tested. They've been tested in a computer model, which is amazing. They do a lot with these computer models, but there are limits. So some of these weapons we would use, we've never really tested before. We've tested them in a simulation. Well, great. You know, remember the aquarium and the Loach? That's a simulation. Sometimes it don't work out, though. But they did say in the Loach description, you be careful with these beasts, because some of them are temperamental, and they will be vicious, and they'll hunt you down with a frown. You'll see the woman in the white gown as you drive backwards towards the future to find your own love sauce. If there is some type of a nuclear attack on Iran, the question also is raised, does it escalate? Is there anybody in alliance with Iran that's willing to stand up for them? And some people would argue that Russia, China, or both at that point would be put into a position where they would need to support. I don't know. I think that their leaders are sane, probably saner than ours, and it seems unlikely to me. I'm playing the game that this is an organic conflict, kids. You know what I think is really going on. But we're playing the game because we're all trying to find the Hollywood ending. So I'm going to give you the Hollywood ending. Although, honestly, like my basic estimate from 10 years ago, this is the most likely and horrific scenario, and that is full-scale nuclear war. So here's the deal. You've got China, you got Russia. They might just be sane enough to say, okay, we're just going to watch it. We'll provide humanitarian support. We'll probably step in and take over the bases we leave behind. But ultimately, yeah, okay. It's also possible that Russia and China see this as another example of where even if you have a kind of deterrence, like the Strait of Hormuz, the United States is just crazy enough to push the button. And that really does raise the question, what do you do at that point if you're China and Russia? Do you stand by or do you act? I think that in a scenario of us using nukes, or Israel using nukes against Iran, if it's an organic conflict, a real thing happening, I think China immediately does the soft takeover of Taiwan. So we nuke Iran strategically, maybe limited, maybe proof attacks. We attack a few of those huge complexes. We probably use several megatons of nukes. And it's god-awful, gross, and disgusting. But we achieve our goal, and we prove a point. In that scenario, China does the soft takeover of Taiwan. In that scenario, I think Russia has the perfect opportunity to nuke Kiev. I didn't say drop a lot of hypersonics on Kiev. I mean use a tactical nuclear weapon against the command and control structure of Kiev. Nobody wants it. But in that scenario, I absolutely could see Russia doing it because the current situation is untenable. And the Ukrainians are not going to probably keep up their situation if that happens. I think it folds. I think the fronts fold. I think generals make agreements with Russian generals. And the Ukraine is temporarily occupied by Russia until they can set up some sort of a government. But at that point, they'll have split Ukraine in half. And there'll be a Ukraine, and there'll be the other part of it that's not now part of, you know, Western Russia. And a lot of these places were historically Russian anyways. So it's not something where we should sort of quibble on whether or not this land belongs to Ukraine or Russia. The point is, if we or Israel use nukes in Iran, I think Russia has a pretext for doing the same. And that's where the map could end. That's the map of the world. We all stabilize around a limited nuclear conflict where Russia, we, a few others, take advantage of the situation. Two countries use nukes. The conflicts end, right? Because, you know, somebody has gone to that ultimate point. Nobody wants to go further. That's an ideal outcome. Here's the thing that people don't talk about in terms of nuclear war theory, especially when it comes to fragile societies. And I would argue a lot of our societies are quite fragile at this point, way more fragile than the powers that be want to lead you to believe. Is that any use of nuclear weapons naturally reduces our ability to control the conflict. Period. Nuclear weapons are caustic to those systems and structures that allow us to maintain civil society. They destroy communications, they destroy, you know, food supplies, they destroy infrastructure in a way that conventional weapons do not. They obliterate and they completely sanitize and remove life completely from areas. So as you drop bombs, you make the situation of finding peace more difficult. And then the other issue is this: do we have a means by which to control it if we really were being honest? The Russians supposedly have things in existence, things like a doomsday switch. I don't know if they do have a doomsday switch or a dead man switch. It's possible they do. It's a very fearful story. It's like that Poseidon torpedo they supposedly have that is like 100 megatons. Maybe they do have a 100 megaton super torpedo. And if they do, I'm not going to say God bless them, but it's gross. It's disgusting. And we probably have scary shit like that also. Something to keep in mind with the Iran conflict is that there might be weapons we have. We just don't want to reveal what we have. That's one of the angles. If I was China and Russia, I would be asking myself, what does the United States possess in a situation like this? And if you wanted to be smart, I don't want to give any credit to anybody being smart here, but we're playing the magical game where we're talking about a real conflict and not a movie. In this magical game, there is a play whereby we have truly advanced technology, but we just don't want to reveal it. We want to save it. We want to keep it behind the curtains. There's an argument to be made for something like that, to tell you the truth. like to not use those weapons, because if you do use those weapons, you let the other guy know what you have. This could also be true with Iran. Iran might not have used this most interesting stuff yet. And these are very intelligent people, folks. These are not dummies. These are not, you know, everyday schmoes. They have engineers and mathematicians up the yin-yang, and they have people who know what they're doing. They could have weapons we don't know about yet. One of the reasons why we kind of just tucked our tail may be because we learned about some of it. Some of it that the public doesn't know of, but they know of. They might have advanced anti-aircraft directed energy weapons, which means they don't even need missiles. They simply shoot a beam at an airplane and it falls. And why? Because all these planes have microchips and electronics, and that's just the way the cookie crumbles. So the deal is, once you start a nuclear war, trying to keep it from going and getting worse is hard. Every hour a nuclear war lasts, it gets harder, and it's logarithmic. It's orders of magnitude worse every hour. And it accelerates, so then it becomes every 5 minutes. But the point is, you reach a point in the game where somebody says, we're simply going all the way. And then when you talk about the triad, and every country that can have one has one, you talk about the final leg, the submarines, in the case of the United States mainly, and these things will simply surface and launch their missiles too. So if you understand how many megatons we have, which is plenty, you could set back the human race by 1,000 years. And so the humans that are left alive, and there will be people, I don't think we would use enough nukes, because some of these nukes are going to fail, by the way. This is just the reality. Not all of them will work. Not all of them will be fired. The good news about nuclear war is it's caustic. Well, the bad news is it's caustic to the means by which you stop the war. The good news is it's caustic to all command and control. So in my opinion, barring the whole dead man switch scenario, a lot of these weapons won't be used, and many of them will fail. Things fail. It's just the reality. The more complicated, the more likely they're going to fail. Just the truth of it. Nothing's perfect. Even nuclear weapons aren't perfect. So if it was full-scale nuclear war, your worst-case scenario, your horror film ending, probably does look a little bit like that movie The Road. Maybe not that bad everywhere, by the way. Some places will do fine. The Southern Hemisphere, barring the storyline of, you know, on the beach, the Southern Hemisphere probably will do pretty well. So living in Antarctica, for example, could be an ideal place to live in the case of full-scale nuclear war. The radiation will cause damage, but we've learned a lot from Chernobyl. We've learned a lot from Fukushima and other places that, yes, it causes damage, but life does continue. It's not good for people, but a lot of other forms of life seem to deal with it. Not okay, but deal with it. Same with Chernobyl. We have many decades of information now about Chernobyl. I think almost 40 years. It'll be 40 years soon, I'd say. So if it was full-scale nuclear war, you're talking about a world living a way that we haven't lived for at least 1,000 years, and technology could be set back by 1,000 years, and it might take 1,000 years for the human race to recover. Some places may do a lot better than that. But overall, if you live in the Northern Hemisphere, it's going to be pretty fucking crazy. And 1,000 years might not be too far off. So that's your happy story, your happy, shiny story time.